What would have been very nice for Mother's Day is like some affordable childcare, universal pre-K, universal school lunches. But instead, we get a mommy database from Katie Brett, who's like, Happy Mother's Day. It is a database to track who's pregnant and when they're pregnant, so the government knows exactly who is pregnant and who is not.
We got to address the suburban women problem because it's real.
What do an economist,
a microbiologist and state representative,
and a fierce advocate for democracy have in common?
We're all suburban moms. The far right is trying to win over suburban women by pretending they're reasonable, even relatable.
But we're smarter than that.
Join us for a political journey through the eyes of suburban women, one conversation at a time.
Welcome to The Suburban Women Problem, a podcast from Red, Wine, and Blue.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us. I'm Amanda Weinstein.
I'm Rachel Vindman.
I'm Jasmine Clark.
And you're listening to The Suburban Women Problem. This podcast is all about suburban women, obviously. So I'm very excited to talk to our guest this week about his book, Disillusioned, Five Families and the Unraveling of America's Suburbs. Benjamin Harold is an award-winning journalist who's written about public education for years, and I can't wait to hear more about how the suburbs are, as he calls them, a Ponzi scheme. But before we get to that, how are we feeling today? What's been in the news lately?
Well, I'm just so refreshed after Mother's Day. It's like, it's, you know, it's that day of respite that you need to just make it to the end of the school year. So it's perfectly timed.
That's true.
I hope you guys had a nice Mother's Day as well.
I had a great Mother's Day, but I will say that I'm now like cleaning up for Mother's Day. And I'm like, I don't feel like this is how it was supposed to go. But, you know, it's fine. Like, I 100% appreciate the effort. My 15-year-old took me on a picnic. Her dad gave her money to buy picnic stuff. So she bought like snacks and cupcakes and fruit. And that was really nice. And then she went to the dollar store and bought canvases. And we went to a park and we basically painted. We had a painting contest and we painted landscape that was around us. But I guess she didn't really like prepare. We only had four colors.
Love
to
it.
Work with.
Challenge
no,
accepted.
Three
colors. Challenge accepted.
Red, blue, and yellow. Those were the only three colors she had. So it was really fun. And then the park where we had it also had early voting happening. So I was like, oh, great. I'll go vote as well. So it was a great day. But now I like have all the stuff from the picnic still in the backseat of my car and all the stuff. And I like keep getting in my car and being like, why is my car so cluttered?
This is the most mom thing ever.
I know. Oh, I do not unpack right away. Sometimes like for Girl Scout meetings, that stuff will be in my car for a month. And then I'll be like, oh, wait, it's another Girl Scout meeting. I'm like, oh, yeah, it's in my car. It's already packed. I'm like already there and ready to go.
Done.
I know. What would have been very nice for Mother's Day is like some affordable childcare, universal pre-K, universal school lunches, paid time off for maternity leave. Like all of that would have been very nice for Mother's Day. But instead, we get a mommy database from Katie Brett, who's like, Happy Mother's Day. I've got a new thing for you, ladies. It is a database to track who's pregnant and when they're pregnant. So the government knows exactly who is pregnant and who is not.
Because God
forbid.
It would
be nice if we did that.
I was just going to say what you're about to say, Rachel.
Go ahead, like, go ahead.
Literally in my state, not only do we not have a database to track who has purchased a gun,
yeah.
like it is illegal for localities to
yes.
create a database to track who has purchased guns, who has what guns, who's purchasing a trillion tons of ammunition. And like, why? Why are you doing that?
That militia does not seem well regulated. But women's uteruses, that's well regulated.
And they want to regulate it more, apparently.
Uteruses, that's where the danger happens. I just, like, I don't understand Katie Brett. I would have thought that even some of the criticism she got for her own party, but girlfriend is doubling down. She's like all, you know, all in.
Oh, yeah.
And she's like, I mean, again, she's just going to keep running with that. But when I was looking over like some of the news that happened in this past week, one of the things that really struck me, two stories, but The first one, which is just really personal to me, and it was Mother's Day, is the story about service members and veterans trying to get TRICARE, which is the military insurance, to cover fertility treatments. And this is a bit of a PTSD situation for me. I mean, in some ways, not like a huge, but I mean, we paid for fertility treatments. If you add up the cost of travel and medication, which the medication is like a huge part of it, we've talked about that on the show before, well over $100,000 that we did not have. We did not have it because we did many rounds and there were, you know, different factors. So anyway, I'm glad to see you. I'm glad to be being part of the discussion. I'm glad for people to see. And frankly, all insurance to pay for. Because in Europe and most countries, you do get a couple of cycles paid for by the government to include medication. And it is not something that insurance companies are required to pay. And most of them do not.
That's, you know, it's one of these things where, you know, I think that there are a lot of people who just do not understand any of this process.
Yes.
And so for a lot of people, they probably had no idea it's not covered under insurance. It's not covered under TRICARE, because to them, they're just like, oh, well, you went to the doctor, you have insurance. If you don't have insurance, it's not my fault. You know how the people are, and they don't really understand the cost, but also the barriers to getting these treatments.
Yeah, that's a good point. And barriers.
At the end of the day, it really falls back on how our society looks at women. I can go on and on about my own little rant I had last week about basically having an $850 copay slash deductible, however you want to call it, just for a screening, like a follow-up screening for an anomaly from my breast cancer thing. But the point is, someone said this in the comments and it actually made me a little ragey. They're like, well, my husband's elective vasectomy had a $45 copay. That was it. Meanwhile, when I had to get a follow-up for an anomaly on my mammogram, I had to come out of pocket about $1,500.
There were many, many times during our marriage that we could not have afforded that. And my husband has always had a very good and steady paycheck. And it's short-sighted. Amanda can probably speak to the economics of this a little better than I can, but I'm pretty sure it costs much, much more to treat breast cancer than it does to have a screening to catch something very early.
Exactly. Stingy pays twice. Like, come on.
That's the official economic. Yes. Amanda's going to write a second dissertation called Stingy Pays Twice. I can't wait to read it.
I know. I think we need like a Suburban Problem book just called Stingy Pays Twice.
I'm
like,
here for
we
it.
Would rather just do it right the first time, which I feel like, I don't know. I feel like a lot of women are for, like, let's just do it right the first time.
Yeah. And I think the point I was trying to make is that when it comes to women's health, everything just seems to be so like, maybe, maybe not. Should we care? Maybe we care enough that it's available to you, but we don't care enough to cover it, or we'll cover some of it, but not all of it, because like somewhere out there, there's a group that doesn't believe that you should be able to do this because blah, 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 God's will or whatever. I don't know. And I have issues with all of these different examples of how women's health care, I would consider fertility treatments to be healthcare. But the insurance company, the healthcare industry, pharmaceutical industry, all have come up with ways to decide that, yeah, that's not important enough to rise to the level that we should treat it like healthcare. We get to treat it as something extra, some fluff that only certain people should have access to. And I just don't understand that.
I mean, part of that's an issue with our healthcare system, right? When you could change your healthcare provider at any time, like when you quit your job and get another job, and when it's tied to your job, then what that means is there's no incentive to do it right the first time. Because if doing it right the first time means a little more upfront cost, it could be a different insurance company that ends up benefiting, right? Casey has a bill to make health insurers cover hearing aids for children, because in Ohio, they think hearing aids for children are a cosmetic device. It's basically the same as a boob job, right? Just it's cosmetic. It's just a cosmetic reason. Not the fact that you can't hear your teacher. Like, it's just cosmetic why you would get a hearing aid. It's how they treat it. And they're allowed to treat it that way because there's no law that says that they don't have to treat it that way. So we end up needing like law after law after law to make them do the things that they would be incentivized to do anyway if we had one healthcare system where you were in that same healthcare system the entire time.
I'm like really perplexed by this. Like, how on God's green earth is a hearing aid a cosmetic device?
I know. Look at my new blue one I got. Look at this. I put bejewels on that. Like, that's not a thing.
Well, speaking of Ohio, your attorney general, Amanda, has been trying to obstruct implementation of y'all's new abortion protection. So, like, how's that going?
I know. Oh, continually. They like to say it's a state's rights until the state decides the way that they don't want to. And then it's no longer states' rights. Then it's actually just what they wanted all along, which is we don't want people in Ohio to have access to reproductive care. And so they are going to continue to do everything they can to try and obstruct what the will of the people in Ohio, who very clearly said that we want access to reproductive care in all of its forms, from access to fertility treatments, if we want that, all the way to access to birth control, to access to abortion. It should be our choice dealing with healthcare, because it's all healthcare. And in Ohio, they cannot just deal with that. They're still trying to undercut it, which I think is what we're going to see is going to be in the playbook in every state. Mm-hmm. That even if you have access to reproductive care, you get a certain person in office in your state house or federally, they're going to undercut it however they can.
I feel like Florida does this too, right? Like,
well, I mean, yes. So I'm the official Florida spokesperson for the pod. But yeah, I think there's this, it's the same thing of like, but the reason why it's happening in all these states is the elected legislature is not representing the will of the people. We need more talk and education on why this is happening. Like in Ohio, and in Florida, the way I start conversations is, but you know, how do you feel about the abortion ban? Even if you're voting for Republicans, how do you feel about abortion access and reproductive care access? Do you agree with a 6-week abortion ban? Invariably, people say no, even people who voted for Republicans. I'm like, well, I mean, there's a disconnect here. You are electing people who are not representing you in Tallahassee. You're electing people who are not representing you in Columbus. They are doing their own thing to score points in case they want to seek higher office later or to be in with the in crowd, because if they don't, then they will not be accepted. But it is truly minority rule, and we need to identify it, call it out, and explain to people how this is happening. You know, I'm really excited to talk to our guests. I just wanted to mention one thing is our 6-week abortion ban went into effect. And now the closest state where people in Florida can seek reproductive care is Virginia. And I moved from Virginia to Florida with 3 dogs and a child and a husband. And it was a 1,000-mile drive. And Virginia has seen a 10% increase, and it is actually putting a strain on providers in Virginia. And that is a direct consequence of what is happening and what we are forcing people to do and the extreme measures we're forcing them to take in the United States. And we need to talk about that more to everyone. This will be the reality in so many states as long as this nonsense goes on. So that is what is at stake in November, just in case anyone's wondering what the state of play is. That's one of the main things.
A whole lot. All right. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be joined by Benjamin Harold.
I'm so excited about this.
If you want to make a local impact on your community and connect with badass women in your area who can get stuff done, then Red Wine and Blue's program, Trouble Nation, is exactly what you're looking for. We give you the tools, trainings, and techniques you need to lead the charge in your local community. You can start your own local advocacy group or help strengthen an existing grassroots organization. Trouble Nation has 170 groups nationwide, and we're adding more all the time. To start your own group or to learn more, visit redwine.blue/troublenation or click the link in the show notes.
Benjamin Harold, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I am so excited about this.
So we're the Suburban Women Problem, and you wrote a book about the suburbs. So this is a match made in heaven. I'd love to hear more about your book.
Yeah, well, it's a match made in heaven for me too. Like Red, Wine, and Blue was like at the top of my list. So like when we have to do the outreach, I want to be here talking with you all. So this, I've been waiting for this. This is
I love it.
And so, you know, my background, I'm an education journalist by trade. And so, you know, I've written about public schools across America for the last 10 or 15 years. And most of my work for the first 10 years of that really focused on big cities and rural areas. And it seemed like that was the, those were the places where, you know, kind of the gap between the American promise and the American reality was most pronounced. And it just seemed to kind of follow logically that we would find some of the, or that I could find some of the heart of the problems that we encounter, you know, in America and in public schools by going to those places. And then I started seeing all of these headlines that came out of my hometown. So I grew up in a suburb of Pittsburgh called Penn Hills. It was about 10 miles east of downtown Pittsburgh. And my family moved in the mid-1970s. And, you know, we're white, I'm white, and the township was 90% white at the time. And that place worked really, really well for us, especially in the public schools. And I graduated in 1994 and I left and I, you know, went out and became a journalist and started living my life. And it was really a generation later, you know, 20, 25 years after I left, when started seeing that all of a sudden the same school district that had served my family so well was $172 million in debt, was starting to furlough teachers, was slashing programs and services, property taxes were going up, home values were stagnating, and you could really see that suburban dream collapsing and eroding in real time. And it quickly became very evident that it was overlaid with this profound demographic shift. So the public schools in Penn Hills were 72% white when I was there in the 80s and early 90s. By the time all of this bad news comes, they're 63% black. And so what that highlighted for me was like, okay, wait a second. All of those opportunities and resources and grace and all of the things that I received that made my, you know, kind of relatively obstacle-free path to middle-class life possible were made possible by pushing the true costs off onto some future generation. And that in the way the pattern of suburban development works, those third, fourth, fifth generations tend to be families of color, lower income families, immigrant families, people who have been fighting for generations to get into suburbia, expecting and wanting that same generous social contract, especially in the public schools, and then getting into places and communities and finding like not only do I not feel welcome here and that this place is often outright hostile to me and my family and my children, but I'm also on the hook paying for the opportunities that other families already extracted. And so when I kind of recognized that pattern in Penn Hills in my hometown, I was like, wow, this does not seem good. This seems like a big problem. And so I wanted to know first, like, how did this happen where I grew up? And then second, was it just my hometown or was it happening elsewhere? And that's what kind of led me across the country. And I ended up for the book, you know, following five families in five different communities. So my hometown outside of Pittsburgh and then suburbs of Atlanta, Dallas, Chicago, and Los Angeles. And what I found was all of those communities were at some stage of this same process, this kind of, we call it a racialized Ponzi scheme of, you know, suburbs developing to really deliver tons of benefits to middle-class white families. And then those families leaving before the bills come due. And the families that follow getting stuck. And we see that again and again and again.
Wow.
Well, I have to say, I read this book in January, February. Big fan. It's definitely going to be top five for 2024 for me. It is, and I read a lot of books, so it's a big deal. And not really, but it's a big deal for me because it is. And I really devoured the book and I loved it. You know, I really thought, not to step on Jasmine's toes because she lives in Gwinnett, right? I think I remember texting everyone about it a little bit. But in Gwinnett, it was very interesting to me to see how the growth was really because of like after the war, you know, World War II, that is, the military. And it was like pushing, you know, people outside Atlanta. But the story of the family there and, you know, kind of like it was sort of an escalating move and kind of running, hitting into this for several generations or a couple generations, as I recall, you know, and could you talk about that a little? Because I thought it was so interesting.
Yeah, I'm so glad to hear that. And I did too. I was just like, it felt like one of those things where the more kind of questions you ask and more you tug on the thread, it's like the more the story starts to unravel. Mm-hmm. And so the family that I follow in Gwinnett County, they're a black family named the Robinsons. So they're kind of middle class, upper middle class, both have advanced degrees, both work professional jobs. When I met the Robinsons, Nika, the mom, was working on her PhD in public health. Anthony, the dad, was a network engineer and former middle school teacher. And like, these are the kind of parents that every school system should be dreaming about, like could not possibly be more involved in their kids' education. Volunteer for everything, go to every meeting and conference, reteaching math concepts at home, involved in a million activities, just like a lot going for them. And they just love school, like love school and love learning. And so when they moved to Northern Gwinnett County, it was this kind of culmination, like you said, of this multi-generational process. So Anthony's parents had taken this like 15-year journey from the New Orleans area by way of Birmingham, Alabama, to get to DeKalb County outside of Atlanta in the late 1990s. And so what they found when they got in there was initially this feeling of like, all right, we finally made it. This has been our dream for 15 years. And then all the white families left and the tax base got really depleted. The shopping changed dramatically. You had high-end, you know, department stores getting replaced by pawn shops and flea markets. And they're like, what the heck happened? But it wasn't a conversation that was an active conversation, in part because we just don't talk about the suburbs and suburbia until recently and until like the work that you're doing, which is why it's so important. Because once we start talking about it, you see like the elder generations of Robinsons, their children, their son, Anthony, was doing the same thing. But was thinking just, okay, I just need to go one or two rings further out to chase that same dream. And so they end up in a heavily white part, relatively affluent part of Gwinnett County. And, you know, they get a nice home and a nice subdivision attached to like the prominent feeder pattern in the school district. And they feel like, all right, we've arrived. We have it set. And everything kind of goes okay until their oldest son starts middle school. And you have a 14-year-old black boy who is very energetic, who loves attention, who likes to goof around, who gets all A's and B's and is like the nicest kid you could imagine, but he's a 14-year-old boy. And all of a sudden, all of these like 14-year-old boy behaviors, burping in class, spending too long in the bathroom, smacking his friend in the back of the head, that starts to be detentions, suspensions, escalating suspensions, to the point where mom and dad feel like, they're teeing him up to send him to the disciplinary school. Like, we have to get him out of here. And so they've organized their whole life and really multiple generations of the family life to get to this place and into this public school system and now feel like that's a threat to my child. And so part of the disillusionment that I think the, you know, Atlanta area and the Robinsons speak to so directly is this idea of like, we did everything quote unquote right. We have good jobs, you know, all the degrees, everything that we were supposed to do. And we are in this community. And not only do we feel like it's not keeping our child safe, it's not cultivating his gifts. It's not recognizing him for who he is. And we have no idea what to do. Like, they pull him out of Gwinnett County Public Schools temporarily and send him back to live with his grandparents in DeKalb so he can go to a predominantly black school. But he's in seventh, eighth grade. They don't want to have their son living somewhere else. And, you know, they want him where they are. And then it's like, well, we can go private school, but we're already paying, you know, $4,000 a year in property taxes. We have two other kids. How do we afford this? Or we can move further out into the countryside. And like in Georgia, that was not something that they as a black family were interested in doing. And so it was like this sense of like, we did everything right, and we're still stuck in this place. And that, I think, is a really profound thing. And there's a lot of disappointment, disillusionment, frustration that emerges out of that. And it's not just this kind of like isolated moment or feeling in time. It's really a product of this generations long civil rights struggle kind of coming up against its limits with how we've constructed it right now.
Oh, my gosh. That family sounds so similar to mine. I lived in DeKalb. I grew up in DeKalb. I now live in Gwinnett. I have children in the public school system where my daughter literally stood up to the teachers in her elementary school and said, you all are not doling out punishments equitably. She didn't use the word equitable because she was like in fifth grade, but she basically said, when two people do the exact same thing, the one that looks like this gets in way more trouble than the one that looks like this. I would like for you to explain to me why. And she got in a lot of trouble for that. But it was her reality, and she didn't quite have a filter to like kind of figure out how to diplomatically express herself, but she wasn't lying. There was actually data that backed up what she was saying. So the Robinsons sound very similar to some of my experiences, as well as the experiences of a lot of my neighbors. And when you talk about generation. So I live in a neighborhood where a lot of the people that live here, these are their grandparents' homes. So they live here in this house because this house was passed down from generation to generation. So you have them, and then you have people like me who moved in. And for many of the people who've lived here for generation to generation, who was here when Gwinnett County was very much not diverse, they look at not all, but there are some that look at the changes and all these things as some type of threat, as if like we came in to specifically disrupt their way of life. And so as a state representative, a lot of times when people run against me, they run against me to get Gwinnett back to where it used to be. Like that's what they mm-hmm. say. Or they specifically say to prevent Gwinnett from turning into DeKalb, which is predominantly people of color, yep. things like that. So, you know, the word disillusioned, that is in the book title. And you said in interviews that you had to start by breaking down your own illusions about the suburbs. So I'd love to hear more, like what illusions in particular did you mean when you said you had to kind of break down the veil for yourself?
Yeah, thanks so much. It's a great question. And the things that you raised about your own experience in DeKalb and Gwinnett are just so important. So if you don't mind, I'm just going to take a quick second to respond to that, because it really just, you know, hits home. And first, God bless your daughter for getting up and saying what's right. And again, and being in fifth grade of like, A, she shouldn't have to do that. And B, when a child or a family has the wherewithal to say that, like, that's not disruptive, that's honest. And what happens is like, it becomes, it sounds like this was your daughter's experience. And it's over and over again, is that trying to point out the problem becomes another reason to get punished. And mm-hmm. like, that is really, really a devastating message to give to children, that if you're being honest about what's unfair, you will get punished. And there's like, there's no right answer. Like even with the Robinsons and Gwinnett, I mean, they came into meetings with PowerPoint decks, multiple pages of talking points. They were bringing in pastors, you know, they had every resource you could imagine, and there was no right answer for them. There was nothing that they were going to do that was going to bridge that gap, because it had to be meeting halfway, and the school system at that time in that place was not willing to do it. And so, you know, for me, part of the unlearning and unlearning my own illusions and kind of mythologies about suburbia and my own experience as a white guy who grew up in suburbia was, one, just like starting to examine my own story in relation to other family stories, and Robinson's being a great example. So Corey, you know, having all of these discipline problems, it's like, first, like, well, that's really unfair. That's not right. But then it made me think about my own experience. So when I was in third grade, for example, you know, I was the kind of kid I would like, you know, scribble on my desk or, you know, draw on furniture when I got bored. And my teacher didn't punish me. She brought in a typewriter from her home and said, you know, whenever you get bored, you don't have to pay attention in class. Go do what you want to do there. Like, that was my first journalism job. I started a class newspaper. Like, that's, you can see how those opportunities come together. And then a couple years later, you know, I was very into writing by that point, and I got invited to this thing they called Authors Day in Penn Hills. And it was this idea of bringing together young, promising writers. And I actually got caught stealing money on the playground. I was, again, a dumb kid doing dumb kid stuff. But unlike Corey, who gets these escalating series of punishments for very minor things, I got told, you have a bright future. Don't screw it up. We're going to let your parents handle discipline. You go back into Authors Day. Mm. And so like that experience, or those two experiences, start to feel very different to me as a white person once I start to say, oh, wait, other families from other racial backgrounds, other stories are having very, very different experiences. So that was one. You know, I think two was this idea of like trying to make sense of the racism that is really at the heart of suburbia in a way that traces back not just to individual feelings and attitudes and motivations, but it's a structural thing. You know, when the federal government essentially subsidized the development of suburbia, it for years said, you know, we will only fund this development or guarantee your mortgage loan if it's a segregated neighborhood. You know, I tend to approach things intellectually. I'm a journalist. I had a background in education policy. I wanted to understand the problem. But once it was like, oh, no, wait, I personally am implicated in this, like this cycle that I'm describing, my family and me, myself, were a part of it. And when I went back to Penn Hills and I met the African-American mom who now lives three doors down from my childhood home and is on the hook for that debt that my family left behind, us having to talk about that person to person, like it wasn't an intellectual conversation. That's a human and an emotional conversation. And that wasn't something particularly as a journalist and writer that I was used to bringing into my work or into the way I made sense of things. But it wasn't until I was able to say, listen, I need to really take a look at my own family and my own experience in order to, you know, not just write a good book, but to make sense of all of this stuff that I'm seeing. That was a moment that ended up being really key in the process.
Wow. I loved how you were talking about like, we've seemed to be much better in this country at covering things up rather than fixing the issues and whatever those structural issues are. And I think it's really interesting the way you talk about like how something that could have been a disciplinary action for you, writing on the desk, turned into an opportunity. And because of these structural issues and issues around racism that we're not fixing, you have a lot of kids who aren't getting the opportunity because we're not seeing the diversity in classrooms or the diversity of the way kids think and react. And so they're not getting their needs met and they're missing out on a ton of opportunities that people had in the suburbs. So I'm wondering, you know, I am sitting in a suburb. I know the three of us are sitting in a suburb right now. What can we do about it? Like, we are taught school is important for our kids, right? We are taught school is the pathway to economic opportunity. Most every parent is looking for a great school because we want that pathway for our kids. But what do we do to make sure everyone has that opportunity?
It's a great question. And I think part of it is there's a sense of like being able to step back and see and understand and make sense of our own communities, environments in ways that because we don't talk about suburbia and because we've covered up so much of the kind of impetus for creating so many suburbs in the first place, which was really to abet white flight, because we don't talk about that, we don't understand what we're seeing when we drive through our own communities. And I felt this going back to my hometown. I thought I understood it, and it turned out I didn't understand it at all. And so part of what I hope is that people who read the book and get the chance to talk about it and, you know, and beyond even the book, doing the work in their own communities, like the kind of work that you all are doing, it's feel like it's so important because it gives us a sense to say, oh, wait, like this thing that I notice in the back of my mind all the time, like, why aren't these roads getting repaired? Or like, why when I cross over the boundary from this town to next town, it's right next door to each other, but all of a sudden the housing stock changes a lot or the quality of the public schools changes a lot. Like, we almost tend to assume that it's like the natural order of things or it just kind of happens, but it doesn't. There's a reason for all of those things. And so being able to have a lens and a framework to understand like, hey, here's where my community sits on this kind of cycle of this like racial Ponzi scheme cycle, I think helps one, just kind of like be aware of what's happening and what's likely to come down the pipe. And so a place like Gwinnett becomes a great example. And, you know, you mentioned this idea of like, you know, people who run against you as candidates saying we need to take Gwinnett back or we need to keep it what it was. Like, particularly when the school board changed from all older white people, predominantly Republicans, many of whom had been on there for 10, 15, 20, 40 some years on that school board, you know, they got challenged by a group of younger progressives of color. And when I talked to the older white school board members, they were very explicit of like, hey, we built this great thing that everyone's coming here to be part of now. Why do people want to change it? We should be trying to keep it the same. And not having the, you know, either the willingness or the wherewithal to say what we built worked for who was here, but it doesn't work the same way for who has come. And our job is to serve who's here now.
You know, Benjamin, I talk about your book all the time. Again, I'm a big fan. I've already said this, but it is so important because for me, on like kind of a continual journey since 2020 of trying to understand this as a white suburban woman who grew up in a white suburb of Edmond, Oklahoma, that my family moved to in the 1889 land run of the middle of Oklahoma, like steeped in this like suburban lifestyle. And it is hard sometimes to examine those long-held beliefs because it's just a very difficult process. And the reason why I recommend your book so much is it is actually, although I found the story in Gwinnett like really fascinating for a lot of reasons, it's the story in Evanston. It's the story in Plano, because that helped me find the words to kind of articulate what formed my views and the people around me. And so it is like an unwillingness to change. I mean, in Evanston, it's kind of a woke thing. And in Plano, it's kind of a Texas thing, if we're being honest. But it is a mindset. I don't agree with it, but I leave the space for people to have their own beliefs. But when you know and understand what's happening, then you can fight it. And so I really like your answer to, you know, of how we can do it. But it's kind of understanding the problem and the process and what has happened. And you also go into great detail of just, you know, it's the budget, you know, it is like these schools, they have really expensive. I mean, you can build a school that's beautiful in 20 years, you're going to have to put money into it. Where's the money going to be to put into that? Are we doing levying, you know, taxes? What are we doing? What is the mechanism for that? And it's going to cost money. And that's the Ponzi scheme aspect. And at first, when you said Ponzi scheme, I was like, oh no, I don't know if I'm going to like this book, but I did. And And I understood it, you know, I understood it, but I mean, the reason why is it kind of stepped on my toes. I mean, you know, because I am a girl who grew up in the suburbs. I am a girl who lives in the suburbs. I'm not a girl, I'm a 50-year-old woman, but I mean, you know, this is everything that I grew up with. And so again, I just really encourage people. You tell this through people's stories and experiences. It's a very readable book, you know, that is, you understand. And also, you know, even for the people with whom you don't agree or identify, like, you see where they're coming from, even if you don't agree with it. And you do a very, very good job of treating everyone with respect and dignity, regardless of their views. So I think you also did that very, very well. So now ends my infomercial on your book, but I do really, really recommend it for all of our readers.
Well, I definitely appreciate that. And, you know, I feel your struggle, feel your pain too. Like, that was part of my process of writing it, you know, like,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I felt that.
Penn Hills, you know, again, as a white guy coming back to my community that used to be 90% white and now public, especially in the public schools, majority Black, it was a sense of like, I thought I understood what was happening. But again, intellectually, I kind of had a, you know, a theoretical sociological framework for stuff. But when Bethany Smith, the mom who now lives three doors down from my childhood home, and I started talking, it was really, really hard. Mm-hmm. And in ways that I didn't anticipate. You know, and at one point, Bethany said to me, she said, you know, Ben, I'm really uncomfortable with this.
Yeah.
Like, you're asking me for a lot. My story, you know, to kind of go through this difficult emotional terrain, you know, you keep calling me, you ask me about all of these problems, and I have to live here. Like, I'm trying to get through my life, and you're kind of asking. And she said also, you know, I'm like, the way Bethany put it was like, I see American history flashing through my eyes every time you call. Like, there's a long pattern of white people coming back, taking Black people's stories, profiting off it, and we don't get anything. It's like, I'm not okay with that. And like, part of what I had to get with is she was 100% right. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't come in with an adequate plan for that. And so I needed to really step back and hear that and then figure out, okay, well, what are we going to do about it? Because once you kind of acknowledge that it's right, it's true, it's real, then it's like, okay, have to be accountable to that in some way. And it takes time and hard work. And so in the case of the book, what ended up happening was I invited Bethany to write part of the book herself. And she ended up writing the epilogue. And it's just powerful. It's like, if you don't read anything else, just go straight to the epilogue and read that. It's wonderful. And it didn't solve everything. Like, you know, it wasn't like kumbaya and we were all like happy and everything was easy after that. But it was the willingness to listen to each other and to kind of keep coming back to the table to say, there's something in here that's valuable for me that I need to learn and know. In my case, it was kind of like getting that personal emotional involvement. And in Bethany's case, it was like, you know, she kind of came to the conclusion of like, you know, I try and keep myself in my bubble because it's hard enough just to get through the week, you know, getting my son to school and work and family and all of those things, which is totally understandable. But, you know, where she kind of came was like, I am swimming upstream now. Like, it's like trying to make what my dreams work in this, you know, aging, struggling, heavily in debt suburban community. I can't just step on the escalator and get where I want to go now. And that's not fair. And we need to address and change that. But in order for me to get where I need to go and where I want my son to be, I have to get involved. And so she actually became, you know, kind of came out of the experience and became an advocate for the fair funding fight that's been happening in Pennsylvania for 8 or 10 years. So, you know, I think that there's a lot to be said for the, you know, being willing to be uncomfortable, being willing to listen, and like not having to have an answer right away. And so it really does come down to the hard work that folks like you are doing every day of like, how do we organize our communities in order to address these very real challenges, but do it with an understanding of like, hey, if I'm in Gwinnett and I'm working around discipline in the schools and, you know, someone else is in Compton and working around trying to get the potholes in the roads fixed, those are actually connected. They might not seem connected, but they actually are. And we can learn from each other and we can support each other.
Wow. I love that you also started with conversations, that this is about conversation, because I think I can speak for the podcast that we are a firm believer that conversations are how a lot can get fixed. And just about anything is going to start with a conversation, really understanding people. So Benjamin, I want to thank you for joining us on the Suburban Women Problem.
It was so good to be here. Thank you, Jen, for the invitation.
Thank you so much. Sorry, I was really fangirling. It's the best book. It is.
I'm like literally about to download it to my Audible. I don't know how long it is on Audible, but I'm like super invested.
It's not that long, but I actually have a hardcover and the Audible because I I liked it a lot. But again, for me, it was like articulating these things that I like try to understand, but I couldn't understand, like, why is this experience different? Like, what is happening? And it's a really important part of the puzzle.
When we talk about some of these conversations that we don't often want to have and we're uncomfortable with having, and a lot of them about race, that I find it interesting too, that understanding these conversations, Rachel, I think you mentioned, also helps me understand myself and my growing up and my family. That, like, Jasmine, I think you've said this, that like African-American history is our history. It is like this country's history, and not learning it is not just about the children in the school district of color. It's about all of our kids. It's about all of our kids knowing who they are and their family. And I know that reading books like The Color of Law and Cass, like, help me better understand my own family and, you know, and these systems that are put in place that we don't realize are affecting us the way that they do. And even, so I think about learning about like our highway system, our federally funded highway system was federally funded. Everybody paid for it, but it helped the suburbs and it hurt urban areas. And they had to pay for it too, even though it hurt them. And the suburbs didn't have to pay as much, even though it helped them. And like, we have systems like this continually where the people paying aren't the ones benefiting. And we don't quite realize what that leads to. And a lot of his book reminded me of like all of these systems at play that can sometimes be very boring when we're talking about financing our highway systems, but you don't realize how much it impacts like our neighborhoods and our families and our way of life.
One of the things that really stuck out to me about that conversation that we just had was when he talked about Bethany and Bethany saying, you know what? White guys have this history of coming into neighborhoods and asking Black people to do the emotional labor so that they can benefit from our emotional labor. And I hear this so often that it really stuck out to me. And so I appreciate that he was like, you know what? You're right. Like, I need to sit with that because that's not easy to, I'm sure that's not an easy thing to digest when someone says that to you, but it's just something that really stuck out to me. And I appreciate that she was able to contribute the epilogue because of that, because I think that's a sentiment that I actually hear quite a bit. It's hard to say out loud because it sounds like you're being selfish, but at the same time, it's kind of like, it's almost like she was saying, what you're doing is what you're writing about. You are going to get the benefit of this story. Meanwhile, I still have to live through the actual issues and consequences. Like, you get the benefit of like writing a book. Meanwhile, I'm like working and I'm trying to just make sure my kid, you know, has a great life. So I thought that was interesting.
It's very powerful. I will say it's very powerful what she wrote, that she said that and that it led to that. And she advocated and spoke up for herself and not just herself, but many others as well that she represented. But it is very, very powerful. And I certainly worth reading. Like you said, if you only read the epilogue, which I hope you don't, but it's very beautiful. And just a good reminder for those of us who want to be allies, but, you know, don't stop and think about it. And so we have to educate each other. We have to talk to each other. We have to sometimes assume the best in people, but also have a firm hand with making sure people know the boundaries and understand, you know, what's going on. And I know I always appreciate a gentle, it doesn't have to be gentle, a rebuke, you know, that I need to hear. And she offered that. I've thought about that many times since I read the book, you know, several months ago, of how she did that and how powerful it was and the beautiful result from her speaking up and speaking out.
All right. This sounds like a great place to start to do our toast to joy. All right, Rachel, what is your toast to joy?
My toast to joy this week is to Mother's Day. I had a lovely Mother's Day with my family. And when we were in Italy, we took a cooking class. We made homemade pasta. So we've been, you know, wanting to do that again at home. And so we bought like the, you know, 185 things. It's not true. We don't need a lot of stuff, but we made pasta together because Alex and Ellie need some supervision. And it was very fun to make it. We made enough pasta for our family like three times over. So note to self,
the learning curve.
Yes. It was nice. It was fun to put on some music and just spend time together. So it's a simple toast to joy, but it was a fun little project. I'm not saying we're going to make our own pasta every Sunday, but it is something that's nice to be able to do. So it was really lovely. What about you, Jasmine? What's your toast to joy this week?
I kind of talked about it earlier, but I want to toast to my daughter for doing a great Mother's Day for me. But I also want to toast to all of those people who are really leaning into the May 21st elections. I am very careful not to call them the primary elections because there are actually real elections. So thank you to everyone who has voted for judge, because that is the general election for judges, including the Georgia Supreme Court, which I think is very, very important with everything that's going on in our current political climate. So if you haven't voted, please do. But if you have, shout out to you. Thank you so much for making your voice heard. It is so absolutely important. All of the things that we talk about here on the pod, but a lot of things that touch your everyday life really, truly do matter when it comes to these elections. And so please don't sit this out. So that's my toast to joy, is to voting and to a great, great Mother's Day that I had.
Love it. Vote. All right. Also a Mother's Day toast to joy for me. I really love the stuff my kids make me. It is great. And aww. I want to toast to all three of them who all made me something. And it was all touching. My oldest made me a little, she took a little Tic Tac case. She's a little crafty. And she turned it into, whenever you need a word of encouragement, you pull something out that she wrote for me. I know, it's so cute. And my daughter made me this gorgeous flower. She's my artsy one. And my son wrote a book, which, so in our house, I am the bad cop and my husband is the good cop.
Same.
And I'm fine with that role. But sometimes, yeah, sometimes I worry like, oh no, they're going to hate me. And Mother's Day is a great day when I'm like, and I try, even though I'm the stern one, I am the they should follow rules one, I am the all of that, where I told them, even when I'm frustrated with them and I'm mad at them, I've always been like, I always have a hug for you. And sometimes even like in the me being like, you shouldn't do this, you need to do this, I'll be like, can I have a hug? I feel really bad right now. And I'm like, yes. And then I will continue talking with them. But so my son wrote in this little book that I always have a hug. And it almost made me, you know, it did make me cry. And I was like, I do always have a hug. And it made me feel really good. So that to know that like he picks up that I might be the bad cop, but I always have a hug for him. And so that was really touching. All right. Thanks so much to everyone for joining us today. If you haven't signed up for our Substack yet, it's a great way to hear more from us throughout the week. It includes news, deeper dives into our guest interviews, videos, and more. And it's free. You can sign up by clicking the link in the show notes or by searching for The Suburban Women Problem on Substack.com. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you again on another episode of The Suburban Women Problem.
The Suburban Women Problem was created by Red, Wine, and Blue. Our producer and editor is Amy Thorstenson. Our project manager is Lindsay Quist, and our editorial assistant is Abigail Martin. For more information about upcoming events and trainings, or to learn more about Red, Wine, and Blue, follow us on social media or at www.redwine.blue.